Now entering Nerdist.com.
Big Pop Fun.
It's Big Pop Fun with Tom Wilson. Tom talks about life, showbiz, art, and more from the Wilson World Studios located in California. About a half-hour drive through traffic to the sparkling Pacific Ocean, where it's only $7 to park. Here's Tom.
Hello, everybody. Welcome. Welcome, yes, to another episode of Big Pop Fun with Tom Wilson, the podcast gentle enough to use every day. Thanks so much for being here. I am Tom Wilson, your adjective-less host. I always come up with a couple, and I was just stuck on lovely. So I've got index cards full of adjectives in my pocket, but I'm not going to use them. I'm going to let you do that after you listen. Welcome to another magical sleigh ride of enchantment and wonder as we fly off to a new us. Yes, all together. Not that us that we got tired of last year or last week or that we got tired of yesterday. No, we're flying to the new us. No, not the same us with new junk. No, that just distracts us. No, we're flying to the new us, more patient, more kind, open to new horizons, and this is how we're doing it, by producing or listening to a podcast at the precise lower middle of the podcast industry. Although an industry should actually have some kind of income we do have income, which is emails from you and postcards from you. Thank you. Thank you very much for your emails. You know those shows on television where the host, like the kids' shows, and the host comes out and looks through the magic mirror and says, Timmy, you're not taking your vitamins. Oh, and I see Jeannie, and you, don't be so scared of school. Well, I have these emails, and I would love to say thank you, John from Morocco, for telling, but I don't have a list of the people, and I don't have a screen up in front of me right now. I kind of open this up and just go for it. So, but if you emailed, I thank you and I appreciate it very much. I'm always open to your questions, your comments by email, info@TomWilsonUSA. I also, of course, thank you for your postcards. Postcards are kind of, they're a little bit neat because it's sort of an interesting connection to people. And when they send them, I kind of have them in my hands. I have Jesse Owens flying through the air in the long jump in the 34 Olympiad. I'll look on the back. I'm taking too much of your time. Anyway, it's Jesse Owens flying through the air, a postcard. Thank you so much, Jean-Louis. The podcast, as always, is – I have a frog in my throat. Let me have a sip of tea, if you would. Thank you. I hope that worked. Oh, I love tea. I love hot tea. I love iced tea. I love tea. I don't like lukewarm tea. My parents loved coffee. They were coffee people. They were literally almost shaped in coffee beans. They drank coffee by the gallon, by the pot. Our house, when I was growing up, it actually had the percolating steam coming out of the chimney because there was so much coffee going on. And oddly enough, in a house steeped in coffee, I believe that coffee is very close to drinking kind of liquid dirt, and I love tea that my Irish grandmother, Lelia Kilroy, used to give me when I was very young. That's good for what ails you. I mean, she would make me hot tea when I was like 3 years old or four or whatever, and put a cup of tea in front of me. And now, of course, she put enough sugar in it that you could stand up the spoon and, you know, not, you couldn't even stir it. It was kind of a thick paste of sugar with some slight tea flavorings. So now when I'm at the coffee place or whatever having my English breakfast tea, I ask the person that I'm with to please excuse me and turn their back while I put sugar in my tea because I find it humiliating because I don't put a lot of sugar into tea. I back the truck up. Why? Because it's good, but we're flying to a new us, and maybe the new me is that tea without any sweetener at all in it. I can't imagine how you people do that. Anyway, I've been doing improv and sketch comedy for many, many, many moons now, as the Indians would say in a Western of the 1940s. Decades, though. I was in a thing called the Comedy Store Players. Yeah, big. The world famous Comedy Store on the Sunset Strip, as I've talked about on the podcast. But the Comedy Store is right there on the middle of the Sunset Strip, and I was in the big, spectacular Comedy Store Players, which it was lots of people in L.A. in the early 80s that had put together sketch groups and improv, and we were doing sort of, you know, whatever, sketches or improvs, performed in the main room there at the Comedy Store on Monday nights. Now, of course, this was coming after the sketch groups of the 70s, improv groups of the 70s that have made themselves famous, Second City or The Committee or War Babies, the Ace Trucking Company with Fred Willard that I had seen on television in the early 70s, which were these seminal figures in early sketch and improv. Well, the owner of the Comedy Store decided that she was going to be the one who named groups. I still have a frog in my throat. I'm going to take another sip of tea. My apologies. headed off to the new us without a frog in my throat. So Mitzi Shore, the owner of the Comedy Store, decided she was going to have the ability to name all the groups. So you got together with some people and you kind of applied to her, can we be a sketch group within the umbrella under the Comedy Store Players? And she would say yes, she said no to many people, but she said yes to me and a group of people. And we had a group that she called Strudel. Yes, I have. We had no idea why. I still have no idea why, but it was called Strudel, I guess because that's cute. And there was a group called Strawberries and Cream, and there was a group called Cream Chip Beef on Toast. I don't know. There were unusual names of groups. Actually, Strawberries and Cream, kind of half of the people quit, and half of the people quit in Strudel, so we made a group called Strudelberries. I know, it's really cute, but we had to. Yeah, because Mitzi named it. Anyway, they were odd names, but a lot of very prominent people came out of it. In Strudel, Robert Townsend, the director and actor, Arsenio Hall was in it with me. Andy Garcia, the very famous actor, used to come and do the potluck players, the kind of open, sort of an open mic for improv. You'd get on stage with a lot of people, and everyone would just kind of go crazy improvisationally. And of course, Robin Williams was there all the time to just hop on stage and enrich any sketch that was going on at the time with his unique brand of sweatiness and thievery. Anyway, but enough about Robin Williams. Well, look, it's not a resentful thing, but I'm just like, I have a podcast. I don't go after people on my podcast. I don't have long diatribes about it, but can we be honest with each other? I mean, we have to be honest, right? Or else what's the point of this whole thing? So yeah, Robin would come up and, you know, do the sketches or watch the improvs, and then they'd show up on the Tonight Show. So, but I never got to do sketches or improv on a TV show. I never did. I never got the shout on SNL, you know, Saturday Night Live, not Fridays when that was on ABC. Well, there were a lot of sketch shows that were coming out on television. And nope, never happened. There were a million of them. And I was never on Mad TV. But my guest, the lovely and talented Phil Lamar. See, I took a couple of adjectives from the index cards in my pocket. The lovely and talented Phil Lamar made his living and made his mark in show business doing really great sketch comedy on Mad TV, and went from there to a wonderful career in movies and television and voiceover. Well, as he'll tell you, his career in voiceover actually started before Mad TV. As a kid, he was one of the actors on the Mr. T cartoon. So take that, people who weren't on the Mr. T cartoon, including myself. We recorded the episode at Phil's house. When I got there, I found that Phil had a cat. As you all know, who have been listening for a while, I'm a nominally functioning bubble boy. And if I'm around a cat for a really brief period of time, it could mean a hospital stay. So we actually went to an outer an outer patio at Phil's house, which was lovely and sun-drenched and beautiful, but the wind was blowing a little bit. It was a little breezy, so forgive me for those times when the wind kicks up with the microphone, because I am the consummate professional, except for my equipment, my technical knowledge, my approach at being a host, or my podcasting acumen. Enjoy my conversation with Phil Lamar.
Hi, it's Big Pop Fun.
Right, we're out on a veranda overlooking...
I prefer to think of it as an atrium.
Atrium, yes. Well, you do
not even know what that is.
The butterfly enclosure, I really think, was a nice touch, Phil. But we are overlooking on trash day, it seems. We're outside as the trash truck comes by. And
I love that it was completely quiet as church until we began recording.
Exactly. We turned it on and the trash. But, hey, we have to get rid of our trash. But we are overlooking downtown Los Angeles, and it is beautiful.
Yeah.
Where are you from, Los Angeles?
I'm born and raised here, yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah.
In this neighborhood?
No.
The undisclosed neighborhood location?
No, I grew up in... I was born in Bellflower, grew up in Inglewood, and then we moved to the North Valley right about the time they were busing kids from Inglewood out to the North Valley. So I saved myself like a two-hour bus ride.
Why take the bus, Mom and Dad? Let's just move there. Right. To the North Valley, what's your...
Granada Hills.
Oh, sure.
At least that's what it was called then. Now, you know, they rename everything these days. I think it's called North Hills now.
Oh, North Hills.
Yeah, so we can charge 12% more.
Yes. My nephew went to North Hills Academy.
There you go.
Which is actually a public school, but they North it is. But they just we're going to call it North Hills Academy.
That's right. Trying to get some of those private school people back.
Exactly. So you just say, "Yeah, I went to North Hills." Oh, North Hills Academy. No, I haven't heard of that. That's in the.
That's hilarious. Valley.
Yeah, it's just a public. It's a public high school. The kids go.
They should call it St. Joseph's.
Exactly. Yes. Something.
Just
they don't have to be Catholic. Yeah, St. Joseph. No, it seems
it's non-religious in every way, but we just called it after a saint.
Exactly. So you grew up. In Inglewood, and then to Granada Hills. Now, was that a culture shock?
It really was. It was. I mean, because Inglewood and Compton, my aunts and my whole family had moved out from Arkansas and all lived down in South L.A. But she decided to, change it up and move us out to the Valley. And it was funny because we were, as far as diversity, it was us and one family that people thought might be Jewish. We're pretty sure.
Yeah.
We're pretty,
Because Granada Hills is in LA. It's suburban.
Oh, yeah. Very
white.
Suburban.
Well, it's Hispanic. Well,
probably less now than it was then. But back then, it was Encino was the TV valley, but Granada Hills was the real valley. Yeah. That was Hesher, mullets and concert tees.
Oh, really? Just dudes, huh? Just,
dude, this is a real Val, dude. What up, dude? And it was funny because. At the time, it really was almost entirely white, really suburban. I remember we would ride our bikes up the hill and past to a point where all the houses, all the development stopped. Mm-hmm. And then there were just these hills, oh, dude, let's get the mongoose. Let's do the dirt biking,
Right.
I went back there a few years ago. I'm like, oh, right, we used to ride up here. And I tried to find the place where the houses stopped, and they don't stop anymore.
Right.
The houses just continue. Everything's developed. And also, the nature of the area has changed. I remember I used to have to, if I wanted my haircut, I used to have to go back to Inglewood.
Oh, in order to get someone who knew?
There were no,
well, should we put a bowl on it and cut around?
No. Well, let's get your hair wet. No, we don't do that with this hair, but now, a barber I go to now is in the Valley. I'm like, there's a black barber shop in the Valley? Lord have mercy, who'd have thunk it? Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, but you were talking about the way that it's changed, ethnically, the Valley has really, really shifted from when I was growing up out there in the 70s and 80s. It's a completely different world.
Well, Granada Hills would be very, very Hispanic now in the northern part of the Valley. And it's very diverse, though.
Yeah.
I mean, I think a lot of L.A. now has been diversified.
Right.
Or Encino is very diverse if you like living in the Middle East.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
Encino is really...
It's fascinating.
Yeah.
It's fascinating.
When the outer... you can come, as to Los Angeles neighborhoods.
Right.
And it becomes entirely Spanish. Yeah. The signage, the everything. And there are parts of Encino now where the signs are in Arabic. Like right. you'll run into a block of storefronts.
Yeah, yeah.
And they are in Arabic and everything. Well,
it fascinates me. I remember there was a period in the early 90s where I was playing with a group called Cold Tofu, which was a predominantly Japanese comedy and improv troupe. And there was a guy there who had grown up in L.A. His family had grown up in L.A., you know, like, since pre-war. And he said, yeah, I grew up in Compton. Like, you're Japanese. You didn't grow up in Compton. It's like, but when he was a kid, the whole area where, at that point, my cousins were still living had been predominantly Japanese. And then the blacks moved in. And now, you go back there, you can't find a black family. It's all Hispanic. And it's just like, it goes in these waves and cycles and shifts. It's really incredible to see. I mean, because, like, my wife's from Philadelphia, and we go back there, and it doesn't change. Like, you know, I hear my father-in-law talk about South Philly neighborhood where he grew up, and it's still, you know, I asked him, it's like, so is this, because we drove down there, it's like, okay, there's, you know, Di Bellecci's Italian restaurant and, you know, the Italian funeral parlor here. It's like, yep, that's the way it was, you know, 1920. Like, L.A. is so much more, not alive, but changeable than those older, you know, East Coast cities, which this is the Polish neighborhood, and it has been for generation upon generation. L.A. is moving. There's a tide. You know, the sad part of that is there's so little history, you know, that gets, you know, left behind here, or at least that anybody recognizes.
That some people, I think, try to recognize against just the influx of people.
Right. This was the first mini mall.
Right.
In, you know,
take a picture. This is changing as we're talking about it. Please, someone take a picture. We'll put right. it online because this won't be the same way because people keep moving here and changing it.
When I went to college at university, and that was the first time I went to visit, was the first day of orientation.
You didn't go to New Haven or anything?
I applied to USC. I didn't even visit USC.
I was pretty close to USC.
I'm really lazy. But I just remember going there and realizing, it's like, oh my God, this building that I'm taking English class in is 300 years old. It's older right. than the flag.
Yes.
And growing up out here, that was just such an alien concept. You know, the idea that things last, you know.
Oh, well, that's very true of the East Coast. And then I'm from Philadelphia as well, like Ohio. But then when the Philadelphian, who's been steeped in colonial culture and history, and then you go to Europe, and you go to London,
God.
And then you come to a building, established 1264.
Right. What? What?
Yeah. How is that possible?
Isn't that incredible?
But it is incredible. It is incredible. And Los Angeles, of course, we have the maybe the history of the missions.
Right, right,
in
right.
In the late 1700s. And everything, but those missions are here. But other than that, somebody bought it and made it a Restoration Hardware. So may I ask you a question? Because your wife is from Philadelphia, and as am I. Does your wife, for example, have a Philadelphia accent?
Just on certain words, like if there is a box of crayons, she's like, "Oh, there's a purple crown."
A crown, right?
Now, and this is one we fight about. When you're at the playground, and, you know, there's swings, and then there's the thing that you climb up on the ladder, and then you swoop down.
A sliding board?
She calls it a sliding board.
It's a sliding board.
It's a sliding board.
It's a slide. Now, and my parents were very attentive to the way that we spoke living in Philadelphia.
Okay.
And if we may open up to the honest discussion about race, Big Pop Fun, my podcast, always is. no, but were your parents very attentive to coming out of a place, Inglewood, Compton, that area, for you to speak in a certain way?
You know what?
That is different than the neighborhood.
Not consciously, but my mother was one of eight kids out of Arkansas, and she was the first one to go past high school, you know, after she graduated. Because everybody else basically moved out here at 14, lived with their grandparents, helped the grandparents, you know, cooked and cleaned, and then by the time they got 18, they met a man, had a baby, you know, and went down the road so the next girl could come and move in. And she did that same road, but she stopped at one kid, got divorced, and said, you know what, I'm doing something different, because the rest of my family is averages four kids, mm-hmm. you know, each. But she said, no, just, I only have time for this one kid. I'm going to go back to school and I'm going to try to do something. There are things I want in life. She was really, really good. So she, you know, got her degree, started working for IBM and worked her way up as like, you know, a business person. So certainly for her in that world, there was a conscious need to appear, especially at IBM. She had to speak, dress, and behave a certain way. She wasn't trying to sell no IBM computers.
Right.
No.
Right.
She was selling office equipment. You know, so I'm sure some of that rubbed off. And because I'm trying to think, did I talk like this before we moved to the Valley? I don't know. Probably. Maybe. But certainly, you know, moving to, you know, Granada
moving
Hills.
Moving up to Granada Hills.
When
kind
I
of,
was eight, you know.
Exactly. Right, right.
Like, it's adapt, man.
Right.
You know, that's
right.
just like...
Because my parents, my parents were always... No, they're not called planets. We don't study the planets. We study planets. You know?
Really?
We don't send postcards. We send a postcard.
That's great. Are your parents from...
They're from Philadelphia. Both okay. of them were from Philadelphia.
Did they have the accent or they made sure...
They made sure that they did. My dad was a kind of... yourself up by a bootstraps guy, mm-hmm. Raised in an orphanage, went through this
wow.
whole stuff, went to the University of Pennsylvania, went to Temple University Law School, became right. a lawyer, and I suppose in that same way, felt that if you're going to do this, you must speak in a certain way.
Right. If you're going to be one of the ones who succeeds, because yeah, I'm sure there were a lot of lawyer guys who you know could do the Philly thing.
It just like, sort of yeah, it could easily to people seem like. Like you're going to be, I don't know, like a shyster or something.
Right, right, right.
You're trying to get it over on somebody. Sell them something or whatnot, you know?
God, I love that accent. It's funny, because to me, the Philly accent is one of the least masculine accents.
Why, thank you. It's Phil Lamar. I will disclose the location.
Exactly. Yeah, you know, because, I mean, for on a woman, it's okay. But then you hear a man talk, yo, God, the Eagles. It's like, you sound like a Yenta. What are you talking about?
Yeah, we go down to Philly's game and get some, you know, pretzels or whatnot and, you know, just right. have a good time. Get in a fight.
Get in a fight. That's a good time.
Yeah, go to, you know, you have a good baseball game. You go to the parking lot. You get in a fight. That's a good day. But and now in my last foray into our honest discussion about race, which
right,
we
right.
always do here on Big Pop Fun, was there ever pressure from other African American students in school for you to act or talk or speak in a certain way that was different than the way you were speaking? I'm just saying, if yeah. I may, because a friend of mine, and it was sad to me, and I understand it culturally, but my friend who will remain nameless in high school was so pressured by the other African-American students to act in a certain way and
right.
speak in a certain way that ultimately the pressure got to him, and he did.
Yeah.
And he lost, you know, I mean, I don't, you know, we were sad about it, but he wasn't friends of ours anymore.
Really? Yeah.
He kind of went off and
wow.
said, I'm going in this direction. And it was both sad but interesting
yeah.
In how much purchase it had with him, that cultural pressure
yeah.
of a number of people saying, you're not acting, you're speaking in the right way.
Right, right. Well, it's fascinating, because it's something I've been keenly aware of. I mean, coming through high school, because I went to, you know, predominantly white schools from the age of eight on, and was very aware of difference. And also, I mean, in terms of pressure to sound, I got it mostly from my cousins. Because, mm-hmm. again, very big family, and they were all living together, you know, like so-and-so would go over, so and they lived near each other, and I was apart. And so when I would come visit, I felt like the outsider. It's like, one, I was a only child, and they were all growing up in, like, you know, bands of four and five.
Mm-hmm.
Then, you know, they would all come over together, so it'd be like bands of eight and 12. You know, so that's, a very different, it's like, hi, guys, what are you doing? I'm just going to sit here and read a book. Why are you reading all the time? You know?
Uh-huh, yeah.
And they didn't understand me, and I didn't understand. It's like, why are you all yelling? Why? You know?
Yeah.
And so I was conscious of it, and then when we get to school, I remember my elementary school out in Granada Hills, there was not rankings, any, you know, rankings, but there were three fifth grade classes, I remember. And one class had almost all the kids who were bused in. One class was sort of a mix, and one class was almost all white. Like, the kids were bused in, they were all black and Latino. And then there was a class that was all white. And I didn't really realize it, but I went to that class for math, because I was in the advanced math class. And that was the advanced class. Mm-hmm. Then there was sort of the run-of-the-mill class, which had, you know, white kids, a couple of black kids, some Hispanic kids, and then there was this other class that was all black and Hispanic. Maybe one white kid. I think he was a dwarf.
Sure, that's where we put them.
But it was weird. I'm like, okay, there's something going on here. And no one said anything. That was Mrs. Garfield's class. It wasn't remedial English or anything, but it kind of was, mm-hmm. you know. And all the ways through school, I mean, I was aware of the difference, whether it was a pressure or not. I mean, basically, I think I did then what I do now, which is adapt. Mm-hmm. If I'm, I talk the way the people I'm around talk, you know. If I'm in a predominantly, you know, upscale, you know, white environment, then I'm going to probably talk like this. You know, if I'm around black folks, I'm going to loosen it up a little bit. Hey, what's going on? You know?
Interestingly, I think that speaks to the actor's ear in you.
Yeah.
Because I think that happens. It happens with me. It happens with
absolutely
almost all actors, certainly voice people. It's a, we're enchanted by that sound.
Right,
and listen so closely to it that we start.
Don't you just naturally mirror?
Absolutely.
When you're around comics, don't you talk far dirtier?
Well, you start getting clicker a little faster,
right.
And your responses are sharper, mm-hmm. and certainly more insulting because with comics, you know, you just
that's the
have
currency.
To say, yeah, that is the currency. You've said something to me, so I have to reply sort of quickly and a little cuttingly.
Right.
For no reason whatsoever, other than you're standing there and I'm insulting you.
Because that's the language,
mm-hmm.
and you have to adapt.
Right.
Well, I guess you don't have to. And like you were talking about your friend, I found that really fascinating, because I'm guessing that he was not able to change it up, or perhaps didn't feel that it was allowed. You know, it's like, look, man, because I've definitely heard, you're not black enough. I used to do a whole monologue, because there were all the, you know, when I was first starting out, I was in the pool of all the young black actors.
Mm-hmm.
So we're all going up for the same roles. But there are some roles that, like, I'm not going to get Debo, the gang leader.
Right, right.
But my agent sent me up for him because I fit the suit.
Yeah.
You know? And it's funny because there's this whole list of, you know, Ice Cube, Ice Trey, Z-Bo, Z-Tong,
yeah.
Lincoln. You know, all these roles that I auditioned for and didn't get. Then the ones I did get. Marshall. Robert. You know?
Right, right.
Ben Klein. You know,
yeah.
Those are the ones I auditioned for that I got.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
I always get Clem. Eventually, Clem punches someone.
Now that's a funny thing, because I can see you being cast as a redneck, but you are so not a redneck.
No,
isn't
nothing
that weird.
But the fact, and yes, we all have what we bring to our lives as actors, to our professional lives, and it's only now that I'm thinking. You know, when you're 6'3" and you're a big guy,
right.
You're just, I'm not going to play any ballerinas. No, I'm not going to be wearing a tuxedo.
Right.
I'm not going to be, I'm not going to be that fancy guy.
Yeah.
I'm just, because here in L.A.,
right.
They're just doing kind of one-hour cop shows and sitcoms.
Oh, God.
And if you can deliver the joke or deliver that little monologue at the end of the cop show, you know, you'll be the guy.
Shorthand. Now, this is a story. This is one of the stories that gave me a real understanding of the business in sort of a cynical way that I think helped. When I was halfway through college or something, I interned for a casting company, and I worked under a woman named Carol Dudley, and she was casting a run-of-the-mill TV show run by people who've been doing TV for a generation. I think the director was a second generation TV director,
mm-hmm.
in like 82. So it's like,
right.
Ooh, that's, you're going way back.
Yeah.
And we were casting a army colonel who gets interviewed on a golf course by probably not the fat man, probably Jake. I don't know.
Right.
And I'm sure it was only on a golf course so they could shoot half the day and then play nine holes the rest of the day. And she brought in black actors, Asian actors, you know, anybody she thought could play this role. And then these, you know, run-of-the-mill guys said...
Dude walks in, he just looks like a general.
You look like a TV colonel.
Exactly.
He had his own boots.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. He was stiff as a board, certainly not the best actor. You could tell that just watching him walk in. It's like, mm-hmm. he looked the part.
Right.
And she was, and I was just, like, so disappointed for her, because she put so much work in him, like, but you know them. You know they're not... It's like, I can't do it any other way. What, I'm going to, you know, do my job badly just because they have no taste?
Right. But that's television.
Right. Well, and it's funny. Did you see this article in the Sunday Calendar about the acting classes that are teaching young actors to brand themselves? Did you see that?
No, I can't say
God.
That I did.
It was fascinating.
But I know kind of that movement. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's saying, don't just do that, you know, don't just go out for those roles. Be that type that you are. You know, they'll sit the person up in front of the acting class, and everybody in the class will write down words that person projects to them. It's like, slut, whore. It's like, that's you. That's what people see. So be that. And this one woman that they interviewed, she's like, yeah, you know, I wear sweats around the house, but when I go out to the gym, I wear black. Because that's my thing. You know, I'm kind of dark.
Sort of your life character.
Right. I'm just like, that sounds horrifying. That sounds, so reductive.
Right.
You know, so limiting and unhealthy.
Well, for so many people, for 99% of those young people,
right.
So incredibly unsuccessful.
Right.
It
right.
won't work.
Well, and also, I mean, I get it. I mean, certainly I've gone up for nerdy black dudes.
Right.
Yeah, I mean,
we all want to try our thing. Hey, that's a job.
Right.
We want to buy groceries.
But why do I want to live the typecasting? How is that going to help? You know? I mean, I can go in and play that, fine. But do I have to put tape on my glasses when I walk in? Hi, it's so nice to be here. That seems absurd to me. And also, it seems like you're aiming for the middle. It's like, I want to be the best under 5 actor in Los Angeles.
Right. I'm such a type that they'll know whenever they have those two lines, they can call me.
Yeah.
It's like, or whatever you're doing in your life now.
Right, right.
Yeah.
I mean, I get it. And I think it's probably no less disingenuous than the acting classes that basically sell you on the idea that you can be the star. Because no,
right.
Everybody in this acting class is not going to be a star. But at least if you shoot for stardom and you miss, you're going to land somewhere in the middle. If you're aiming for the lower middle, where are you going to land if you miss? Like, I'm back in Ohio at a car dealership.
Yeah.
You know, why not just go there?
Were you, did you do plays in high school?
Yeah, yeah. That was,
you did a lot? Was that your thing?
That's where I started.
Where did you get the bug?
Well,
what happened?
I was a nerdy kid sitting in the corner reading books while my cousins tried to take my shoes, right? So one day at my high school, my junior high, we were doing a play, a book that I loved, The Phantom Tollbooth, you know, which is just such a great, like, just wordplay and all that. And there was this one little character towards the end of the book, you know, the heroes are on the run, and they're, you know, taken by one of the demons of ignorance, the senses taker. He'll take your sense of duty, your sense of justice, your sense of purpose, you know. And I'm like, oh, I want to play that so bad. So I went and auditioned, and the director liked me and wound up casting me as one of the leads. So I opened the show with a monologue to the audience, you know, and just sort of went through the play, you know, went through the rehearsal process. I was in eighth grade. I wasn't really paying attention. There was no career mind.
Oh.
And out of the corner of my eye, I kept looking at the guy who got the census taker part and just going, oh, you're doing it wrong. But on opening night, we get out there and I'm standing backstage and, you know, you hear all the people, blah, 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 and, you know, they play the music and everything goes quiet and then the lights go down and I'm backstage because I'm the first moment of the play. I'm supposed to walk out to the lip of the stage, wait, just standing in silence, you know, for like a 15-second count, and then talk to the audience. And I just remember that moment of walking through as the curtain opened and out there, and I have horrible eyes, and I wasn't wearing my glasses, so I can't, and also you've got the light in your face, you can't see anything, right?
Mm-hmm.
but I felt the energy from that crowd, even though nobody was, it wasn't like they were clapping, they weren't doing anything, but like there was a wave of energy that came up over the lip of the stage, and just like, I felt it, like with water touching my toes, and like my entire body just felt energized. And the one thought that crystallized in my mind before I started my monologue was, these people are mine. And then I went and did the play, and you know, it was fine, but that moment, that one moment, I think is, you know, that's the dragon I've been chasing, you know, ever since. That's not, I mean, because they always say that, you know, the number one, or was it, like, one of the top three fears that people have, besides, like, you know, death or whatever, mm-hmm. is public speaking.
And I, even when I was a kid, I heard that statistic, and I thought it was funny.
Right.
I really did. That's how, like, I'd say, well, why would that be? I mean, they're just, you know.
I think there are certain of us who, just on some sort of molecular level, can process the energy of the gaze. This is
one of my many crackpot theories, Tom.
Processing the energy of the gauge and go.
And go. When you are talking to someone and not looking at them, it's one level of energy. But when you guys stop and you make eye contact, it's a different level of energy, right?
Absolutely.
And then when you're talking to multiple people and they're looking at you, again, another level of energy. And you can feel it in your body. There is something different. And the more people, the more energy. I think that there are certain people who are wired to process that energy in a positive way. It feels good. There are other people, they get up in front of people, that energy hits them, and they wet themselves.
I think you're absolutely right. I think that's a great way of putting it.
You know,
I really think you're right. And the more people, I haven't tried 17 million people before. Maybe the back of my head blows up. I don't know. Maybe it's too much energy, and I pop a gasket. But
isn't it funny, like when you have a big crowd, You swell to the size, like a goldfish in a bowl.
Yeah. You know? And that's what, when young people have asked, like, what do you do? How do you, when you're nervous and everything? I said, I really have never identified it as nervousness.
Yes.
I have always, I self-identified it as energy.
Right, right.
Like, there are a lot of people tonight, and this is very important. Mm-hmm. I find this incredibly energizing.
Right, right. And I think people who get nervous or nervous in a way that feels bad, like, I'm shaking. Mm-hmm. That's excess energy, mm-hmm. you know? It's like, oh, I don't know what to do, I don't know what to, you know? And, I mean, but also with the stage, that's what the rehearsal process is for.
Of course.
Is all of that. But
and know. Bottom line, I've always thought, well, if anybody can do it better than me, get on up here. Come on, I mean, what, you know? Yeah.
Well, also, and stand-up, I mean, you have to have a certain level of fearlessness, because it really is. You're a gladiator, you know?
You are a gladiator.
Because with improv, it's slightly different. The audience is a little more on your side. Like,
yeah.
you're depending on them for the suggestions.
And they've come to a show where they're saying, we enjoy the high wire, mm-hmm. but we're supportive
right.
of the high wire walker.
Right.
We understand that you can fall. That's a yes. part of this process.
Yeah. It's like watching a sports team. It's like, we don't know how it's going to end.
Right.
We're here to root them on.
Whereas stand-up, that it is a high wire, but the high wire, I mean, you have to tame a line exactly. on that high wire.
And they expect that you've already worked out.
Yes.
Like, yeah. Nobody expects a stand-up to fail.
Right. We want to watch the tricks on the high wire.
Mm-hmm.
If you fall, that's kind of ugly.
Right, right. Or like a magic act. Like, can you imagine if a magician came out and was like, well, that didn't work.
Oh, killed another one?
Oof. All right.
Sorry, dear.
Here, let's try a card trick.
Yeah, she's actually in halves. Can somebody help me with this? Please don't tweet this right away, people. Please, put away your iPhones. No,
let's tell her family first.
A little bit of dignity, please, for my disembodied assistant. Come on. Were you doing improv in high school?
No, I didn't do improv until college.
You went to Yale.
Yes.
To study what?
I didn't really know. I thought I was going to do theater. Yeah, all the schools I applied to had sort of Northwestern, SC, Carnegie Mellon, and Yale. Those are
big schools.
Yeah, those were theater schools. Came down to Carnegie Mellon and Yale, and I basically, like, got scared of Carnegie Mellon.
Scared of Carnegie Mellon to go to Yale?
Well, because Carnegie Mellon was a conservatory program.
Yes, it is.
And it was full-on acting. I'm like, okay, I go to this thing. If I make it through, if I'm not cut sophomore year, in 4 years, I will be an actor. Mm-hmm. Yeah. If I go to Yale, okay, 4 years, I'll have a liberal arts education, and then can, like, that's a little more wiggle room. It's a little more wiggle room.
You get a, yeah, you get a, whatever. You know. Get out of Yale, you buy yourself a scarf, and you can wax wax poetic for the rest of your
yes,
life.
Yes, I'm going to, yeah.
But so you went to Yale Drama School.
No. This was undergrad. Oh, okay. And that's the funny thing. I thought about Yale Drama School, too. It's like, well, Yale Drama.
Sure.
That's a graduate program that has no connection at all with the undergraduate acting program.
That's how they get you. Mm. With the Meryl Streep photo.
Exactly.
They get you.
Ooh, I want to be Meryl Streep. Well, then you'll have to go through 4 years here and then apply. And it was funny because there were like 200 of us freshmen who wanted to be, you know, drama majors. They didn't have a drama major. They had a theater studies major.
Theater.
Well, no, I want to do acting. We have theater studies.
Theater studies.
They had one full-time faculty member for 200 prospective majors.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's like, all right, well, we're going to do a lot of musicals. And we're going to, you know, multicast them. You four will be Tom. You know? It was seriously, it was like eighth grade. Really? Everybody's going to be Hamlet? Okay. They were just, it was crowd control until you got to sophomore year. And then there was one class that you had to audition to get into. And if you weren't one of the 20 people that got into that class, then you couldn't be in the major. So I'm like, okay, well, we're paying all this money. I might as well get an education they want to give me. How about English? Here, you don't have to write a senior essay. And so I became an English lit major.
Really?
Yeah.
That's terrific.
I know. It turned out to be absolutely the best path I could have chosen.
Ultimately, I think it's probably way better as an artist.
Yes, well,
just to read and break things down and everything, and
yeah. I read all of the works of Shakespeare, got to understand them. Mm-hmm. I learned how to interpret text, you know, and I had something going on in my life other than acting and drama and acting class, and you know, it's like I'm stretching, and you know. Yep. For me, it turned out to be great, and I got really lucky.
So, but you were doing improv at Yale then?
Yes.
You joined some...
Well, a friend of ours was from Chicago and came back from a summer studying with Del Close.
Oh, yeah.
And taught, and he said, they're doing this thing, it's called a Herald.
The Herald.
Why? No one knows. Yeah, but it's a thing. And we had, you know, at that time, you know, you didn't have the internet, so he tried to explain a Herald to us. With intersecting circles on a napkin. It's like, well, there's one story here, and there's one story, and then they sort of come together like, all right, let's try it. So 12 of us who had tried to teach ourselves an improv form that we had never seen. Mm-hmm. And it was, we had so much fun just exploring this long form, because none of us had ever done improv, so we're starting with long form. And then we said, oh, this one's like fun. And we wound up going back to Chicago on one of our breaks and competing in a Herald contest with a couple of other college teams. And we won.
Wow, that's great.
And then, you know, like, we love this. This, like, became a mission. Like, I want to live for improv. So we all, as a group, moved to Chicago for the summer after that year and lived there, studied with Del Close, you know, and took classes in Second City. People worked at the, you know, the local deli or whatever, just whatever we could to get by. And it was amazing. It was just a fantastic experience.
Did you start working professionally out of Chicago?
No.
From there, were you working? What did you
do? This was only sophomore year.
Oh,
so then we went back to school and continued to do the improv group, which we started in 85, and it's still going. You know,
at Yale.
Yeah. Which is like, really? Wow, that's so funny. Then after graduation, I came back home to L.A. again, because I was scared. Mm-hmm. Like, everybody I knew was moving to New York, because you're in New Haven. New York is 90 right. minutes away. Yeah. Like, yeah, I don't have any money. It seems cold. I'm going to go home. Fortunately for me, home was L.A. So I came
back. So you
didn't
come home. Yeah, I mean, you came home. You didn't
home.
Go to L.A. to get a guest star spot on Mork and Mindy.
No,
You went home.
Which, yeah, I mean, LA. Path of least resistance.
Yeah.
You know, I got to live for 3 months at my parents' house, you know, until my mom said, let's work on your exit strategy.
Uh-huh.
And, yeah, so I was able to ease into it. And I also had, again, another lucky thing. I already had my SAG card.
How'd that happen?
During high school, a friend of my mother's worked for NBC. and knew I did plays. And she said, well, we're using real kids for this cartoon. You should have Phil come audition. And I auditioned and got the cartoon. Huh. The Mr. T cartoon.
You were a guest star on the Mr. T cartoon?
No, I was a regular. For three summers, that was
three
my summer
summers
job.
As a kid? Wow, that's a pretty good summer job.
Oh, yeah. It was great. It was great. You know, we had our little... We didn't have a teacher because it was summertime. Because they only recorded during the summer. But we all had our guardians would drive us there and hang out. There was one girl, Amy Linker, who was also on Square Pegs at the time. It's like, oh, she's an actress. You know.
Wow.
Me, I was just like, oh, this is just my summer job.
Uh-huh.
But I got my SAG card. And so later when I came back, I'm like, oh, right. I still have this thing.
Oh, it's a useful thing to have.
Excellent. Mm-hmm. You know. And so, yeah, it was a little easier than it might have been.
Were you just auditioning for TV shows and things? Or?
Well, no. I spent the first year not doing, taking acting classes or trying to do things and not doing anything. And basically, by summer of 89, I was ready to quit. And then
this is with and go back to doing what? What would you have done, you think?
I have no idea. I think that's part of the reason I didn't quit. It's like I really don't have a plan B.
And really, the middle of Yale was the same. Middle of Yale is I'm having fun with this improv thing, and I'm doing this.
Yeah,
but
it wasn't career-minded.
I don't know.
Because, well, certainly at the time, the things that I'm doing now, like improv, voiceover, those weren't careers.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Those weren't anything you would like, that's what I'm aiming for. And it's funny, when I meet people today, it's like, yeah, I really want to do what you do. I want to be a voice actor. It's like, really?
Because I never did. It just sort of...
You sort of happen into it. But yeah, I did that first year, you know, hip pocketing with somebody's agent, you know, to send her clients to go pick up her dry cleaning. And I was just like, maybe this isn't it. I don't know what it is, but maybe this isn't. And then I stopped and I said, well, have you tried, have you given it your best shot? Have you tried everything you could? And I'm like, no, I haven't. So I took that bad agent's advice. She said I needed to take a cold reading workshop. I'm like, I don't need no cold reading workshop. But I did, and I took the cold reading workshop. I found probably in, you know, Drama Log or something. And the guy running the workshop had just left casting at Universal to become a manager. And he said, you're pretty good. I'm looking for clients for my new management firm. Would you be interested? And he signed me up as a client. And then because he was used to be head of casting at Universal, he had access to agents, got me with my first agent. And from there, you know, I just, you know, started auditioning for things and, you know.
What was his name?
Mark Malice.
Mark Malice. I think I met him years ago.
Yeah.
But so, and then you went out and then you started.
I got on the treadmill, yeah.
Did that happen fast?
No. That was, what was that, probably, that was 89. It wasn't until 92 that I was making a living as an actor. But I started to audition. And at the same time, I was doing Groundlings classes.
Ah.
But again, that wasn't for a career thing. That was just because I missed improv.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm like, well, I'm working, doing proofreading and delivery for a court reporting service. Yeah. That was my money job. I got enough money to take this class. I love improv.
The Groundlings, for people who don't know, is like Second City. The Groundlings in Los Angeles was established decades ago now.
Yeah, yeah.
By Tom Maxwell and a bunch of people. But it's down on Melrose here and has been a spawning ground of an incredible...
Yeah, just and consistently. Yeah, it's an improv and sketch comedy theater. Yeah. It was, I would watch the shows and just be amazed by people and like, I want to be part of that. And the funny thing was, I would be auditioning for stuff and my agent saw me as sort of a serious kid. He went to Yale, a little kid, and they were putting me out for all these dramas. And then I would also get calls every once in a while from the Groundlings because someone would call there looking for, we need young actors.
Uh-huh.
You know? And to be honest, I was the only black guy in the program. There were no black people in the Groundlings. Pretty much. And I was like probably at second level, but I started getting calls like, hey, somebody's looking for, do you want to go out for this thing? I'm like, sure. So at the beginning, most of my comedy work came through the Groundlings. You know, I would audition for stuff and then eventually they dovetailed. You know, because the Groundlings' skills got, you know, I'm like, wait, you know, I could go out for sitcoms. He was like, all right, give it a try. And then I started becoming like a guest star guy on sitcoms.
As improv, for people who don't know, was sort of more and more accepted as right. both a training ground mm-hmm. and certainly a maybe a better training ground for comedic actors than quote-unquote acting school or well, scene study.
It was really interesting because when I got to the Groundlings, it was a small theater. Like, they had a good reputation. At that point, the people that they would talk about were Pee Wee Herman and Elvira had come out of it. Mm-hmm. But right about that time, John Lovitz and Phil Hartman were starting on SNL, and, you know, Lovitz was huge. You know, Hartman was amazing. And people in the know began to realize, oh, that's a place where those guys came from. Then Lisa Kudrow got onto Friends, mm-hmm. and there was an absolute explosion. Mm-hmm. I believe that was the point where the Groundlings school began to make more money than the Groundlings show.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Because all of a sudden you had basically anybody in Hollywood wanted to go off the comedy and wanted Groundlings on their resume.
Yep.
Pretty girl over there just took like two classes. Yeah, but it says Groundlings, so now she can audition for sitcoms.
Right. Right. Yeah. And now, as you know, the Groundlings have also fueled the writing departments.
Oh, God, yes.
Of sitcoms and comedy movies.
Oh, the guy who runs, one of the guys who runs New Girl on Fox was a guy I was in the Sunday Company with at mm-hmm. the Groundlings, Brett Baer. Mm-hmm. You know, just a really, really funny guy. And that's the thing, it was a great training ground. One for the improv stuff, which just gives you a certain level of comfort, which feeds into auditioning. Then they make you write sketches. And once you have that, like, even if you get cut after that, you know, first writing class, you look back and you realize, I have a stack of comedy that I've written. I'm now a comedy writer.
Right.
You know, and many people went on to, like, amazing careers as that. You know, you talk about Tom Maxwell and mm-hmm. Don Woodard. You know, I used to watch Don on stage. I'm like, that guy's hilarious. Like, but he was even better as a writer. Like, you know, doing too often I was clever, but not funny. And I really do. Yeah. In general, I have to work to be funny. I feel I have a good sense of timing. You know, I have a good feel for the audience, and I'm comfortable, which I think all contributes to, you know, comedy on stage. But I have to work on letting myself loose. And just trying to, you know, if I want to get people like peeing in their pants laughing, I have to work at it. You know, I have a lot of friends who don't.
Who don't work at it.
Who don't need to work at it.
Who just have some giftedness.
Yeah, and just like, you know, they can look at you and decide, I'm going to make you laugh, you know.
What, is that quantifiable? I mean, is it something do they go 4 steps of brain function beyond the person standing next to them to go somewhere a little kooky that gets funny and maybe fails?
I don't know. I think it's a combination. I think some people have just the chops. Some people have the deep-seated need, mm-hmm. you know.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, I need to... I'm not comfortable unless you're uncomfortable laughing, and, mm-hmm. you know. And I think it comes from a lot of different places.
Oh, it's okay. I'm just under the sun here. We're okay. I'll just move up a little bit. We're all good. And so from there, I mean, the basis of your career, I guess, came from the improv. You just went off, or were you doing sitcoms?
Well, yeah.
Did you end up playing, you know, some guy on a cop show?
No, it's weird, because I guess the biggest, you know, step for me was getting onto Mad TV, which was basically that was the stuff I had been doing at the Groundlings, sketch comedy.
Yeah, it seems characters. Like that was you fit into it like a glove. I mean, this was right in your wheelhouse.
It was in a way, except for that the clever funny thing. I think I actually by that point I had developed the skills. I knew how to play characters. I knew how to write stuff. I knew how to edit sketches.
Did Mad TV happen out of the Groundlings, or were you doing a sitcom here and the pizza, funny pizza delivery kid and that kind of stuff? And
well, it's funny because when Mad TV went to look at the Groundlings, I wasn't there. I got in because the people at Fox knew, oh, this is a guy who does comedy. We've had him on a bunch of shows. Take a look at him.
Yeah.
And the funny thing was, I had already done a pilot for Fox that summer. It was the, I believe at that time, the 12th Carlos Mencia pilot. And
darn it! How can we keep blowing the genius?
Someday!
Come on!
And I was convinced, you know, this was going to go. This was great. I mean, the guy who ran the show was so smart and so funny. It was like a Barney Miller-esque cop show, which Barney Miller is a sweet spot for
great
me.
Great show, yeah.
And I was like, this is going to be great. And they said, oh, you want to go in for this sketch comedy show? I'm like, you know, I've been doing sketch for years now. Sure, why not? As a favor. Mm-hmm. And I went in, and it was in second position. You know, that means that I was already committed to this other show first. So even if Mad TV wanted to hire me, they couldn't get me if this other show went. I didn't care at all. And as a result of that, I was so relaxed. You know, I think had it been 3 months before, I would have, you know, had, you know, 6 minutes carefully crafted and rehearsed it, you know, to no end. I came in with you know, legal pad with a couple of notes on it, a couple of maybe punchlines. I'm like, and I was like, hey, how you doing? All right. Here, all right, I'll start with this one.
Wow.
And they ate it up, you know. In fact, one of the producers, because when we did the callbacks at Quincy Jones' company, again, it was weird. I didn't think I needed it. So I cared, but I didn't care. There was no desperation.
You thought you were the star of the new Carlos Mencia video.
Exactly. And when we were doing the callbacks for the production company, there was a woman sitting there, her hand, you know, chin on her hand, sort of like looking bored, you know. And as I was about to start, I looked over and I started looking. I'm like, I'm sorry, am I keeping you awake? And she was like, oh, no. And later, after I got there, the showrunner told me, he's like, oh, man, when you did that, I knew right then, you know.
Wow, yeah.
He was like, I could never do that. Of course, he then found out that attitude continued, and I wound up, you know, telling him, like, am I keeping you awake? It's like, you can't talk to me that way.
And how long did that end up running? That went.
Well, I did the first 5 years mm-hmm. of Mad TV, and the show itself ran for 14 years.
14?
14 years.
Wow.
When I realized that, I'm like, oh my God, that's incredible. And they had so many talented people come through those doors.
Did you have fun?
The first two seasons were amazing. Yeah.
Unfortunately, I was on for five.
Almost half the time was really good.
No, I did a lot of work that I was really proud of, and I met some amazing, amazing people, like cast members, crew members, mm-hmm. you know, writers, you know, people who I, you know, will, that I continue to be friends and will, you know, call my friends for life. But yeah, it was a tough environment. Mm-hmm. You know, sketch is tough. You know, we were doing an hour sketch show, you know, late night. So we were getting paid half of what people who were doing a half-hour show were getting paid.
We're doing double.
Exactly. We're doing double the work. And also, it wasn't a launching pad. Like, SNL's, like, they're slaving. They're, you know, they are working hard for, you know, even less money than we were getting. But it's a launching pad. Mm-hmm. People are watching. The producers are like, hey, why don't we take that and do something with it? We didn't have that. We didn't really have much of an audience. There was no promotion. You know, the first 2 years they tried some promotional stuff. They had a Miller Lite promotional thing. They stuck us on a riverboat in New Orleans for like 8 hours with people who won a call-in contest. Our first
that
season.
That sounds like fun.
Oh, man. Now, mind you, to win this contest, you needed to call an 800 number. You didn't even have to have a phone, Tom. You could call that from a payphone.
From a bus station.
Exactly. And nobody on that boat seemed to care who we were, because they weren't watching shows. It was like, I just heard there's a chance to win some Miller Lite. Nothing on the boat except water and Miller Lite. And you're out to sea. You can't escape. And it's New Orleans in August. I just remember, like, the 8 of us would pile into the one stateroom they gave us, because that was the only place with air conditioning.
Yeah.
And just like, oh God, I guess we have to go back out. And it's like, it's not even like, oh God, these fans. They didn't care. Like, hey, are you one of the ones on the show? Well, get my picture with him anyway.
Yeah. Wow. Well, show business has this way of taking you there. It's just going to, no matter what level you get to, you're going to end up on a riverboat in August in a stateroom with eight people saying, why did we do this?
Why again? The network's really high on this promotion.
Yeah. Was there a moment on Mad TV where you thought, hey, man, this is what it's all about. This is, you know, I have to remember this moment because this is why I came into it. Did it have any of those kind of peak experiences that were like opposite the riverboat?
Was it working so hard
that you're just sort of in the grind?
Well, no, it wasn't that hard. There were certainly moments like where you spend 3 days hacking at a sketch. Like, gosh, how are we going to make? And then all of a sudden it comes together, and then or you see one of your friends on stage doing something, and just like I would watch Nicole, do a sketch. I remember we did the table read, and that sketch was okay. And then you just see her, and it's like Michael Jordan, just like tongue hanging out, doing a slam dunk. It's like, wow, she just took that to the hoop and made that so much funnier than it had any right to be.
Yeah.
Or every once in a while there would be a sketch, I remember there was a sketch a guy named Brian Hart wrote called Insanely Disappointed. It was a two-hander with me and Brian Callen. It was about an office sketch. The guy's like, Dobbs, come in here. Oh, sir, did you get my report?
Yes, Dobbs, and I have to tell you, I found it insanely disappointing.
Disappointing, sir?
No, Dobbs, insanely disappointing. It drove me mad.
And then the sketch takes off from there, and it's like I found myself with my head shaved, wearing a nightgown, howling like a wolf on my front lawn. And it was just, like, doing something like that was just so much fun, Or watching Artie Lang do a sketch called Drunk President. Now, we all knew Artie had just come off of a bender, probably hadn't slept or whatever, and he's doing this thing with him and Dave Herman where Artie has all the lines. Dave's playing the drunk guy.
Artie's not the drunk guy.
Artie's the CIA agent who's got like 3.5 pages of exposition and just nail it. I'm like, how did he do? Did you guys see him last night? Yeah. How did he just do that?
Man, I've never known how those guys do it. I've never been one of those guys,
right.
But I've certainly witnessed it where the dude who is just out of his mind has to pull it together and do a scene. I don't know what that energy is or what clicks or what happens.
I don't know, man.
But
I got to remember Rodney Dangerfield came and guested on the show one time. And, Rodney was probably in his early 80s at that point.
Yeah, but Rodney as Brad,
Well, and it was funny because, they had him doing stand-up and he was sitting on the set and you looked over there and it's like, oh my God, he looks like a man in a rest home. He looks like an 82-year-old man, just sitting there, sort of blank gaze, Then they brought out the mic stand. It's like, all right, Rodney, we're ready to go. And he, shuffles up. But the minute he put his hand on the mic stand, 20 years dropped off him. This energy surged through his body. He's like, hey, how you doing? Like, what happened to the old man that was sitting there a second ago? It was fast. And I think there's something similar there. Like, these guys...
The energy.
There it is. There it is.
Made it happen. Man, I've already kept you too long, but want to talk a little bit about voiceover because when did that start happening?
Well, I mean, my very first professional gig. Was a cartoon.
Mr. T brought you into voice acting.
Not really.
Come on,
I didn't.
Would you think give Mr. T credit where credit is due?
I will
would
give.
You stop
him.
Denying him.
But honestly, thank God we didn't because on that cartoon we were taught, it's like. Make every line end up. It gives it energy.
Really?
Oh, yes. And we were kids. We didn't know. It's like, I'm so sorry. Your dog died. And if we didn't do it that way, they made us go back and take it again.
Oh, wow.
So I don't credit that. Honestly, it was Mad TV because we had these claymation pieces done by a guy named Corky Quakenbush that were just brilliant.
And I wish my stage name was Corky Quakenbush.
I think that would be your porn name, wouldn't it?
If he's out of showbiz, I'm taking it. I think you're allowed to at Screen Actors Guild.
Yeah, you just Corky Quakenbush. Exactly.
Man, I love that. So Corky was making claymation.
Yeah, and they did. Did that rhyme? The first one was this Rudolph, the Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer claymation, the Rankin-Bass thing, meets Goodfellas.
Oh, wow.
So it was like really ultra-violent because we were on late night. And they had the cast voice all those. And that was really my first experience
actually voicing real animation. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, okay, and then we come back in and do it. And that gave me a lot of mic time. And then I got, again, really lucky. There was a commercial agent named Doug Ely, who was at Abrams at the time. Now he runs his own agency, AKA. And he said, I'd really like to represent you for commercials. It's like, I don't do commercials. They give me options. No, 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 but you should do it. It's like, I really don't want to. Well, what can I do? Like, well, do you have a voiceover department? Because I've always thought I could do voice. And so we made a deal. Like, I would go out for commercials every once in a while.
Francis Coppola, I think, is shooting.
Exactly. Okay. Well, thank God it's not John Landis again.
Now. Oh!
Hey. Too soon!
He's
too soon!
Here all week. Wow. Anyway.
Yeah, so that...
So you started. You got
that's when I really began doing... And so it was a combination of having that... You know, Kelly Garner was running that voiceover agency, and he was really energetic, really going after stuff. The women who cast... me on Mad TV, Julie Mossberg and Jill Anthony also cast Futurama.
Ah.
So like a lot of things came together.
Yeah.
You know, so I got Futurama sort of through them. I got that opportunity through them. And then through this voiceover agent, I started getting, you know, an opportunity to do some, you know, mainstream stuff. You know, like I think Static Shock at Warner Brothers came around at that same time. And yeah. And I just got... I mean, I think the character stuff that I've been doing at the Groundlings and on Mad TV fed into being able to... Like, okay, well, here's something on a page. Let me make a character choice and, you know, give it a voice. You know, I think that fed into it as well.
So the character choice comes before the voice.
For me, it does.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, what kind of guy is this? You know?
Because, as you know, and I've talked about it before on the podcast with voiceover friends of mine, that you're probably inundated with people coming up to you and saying, I think I could do voiceover because listen to this. Hey, fell. And you say, well, that's not exactly
right.
What it is, just making funny sounds
yes.
with your larynx. It's,
yeah.
it's about embodying characters.
Yeah, even though voice is first in voice acting, acting really does come first.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's funny because I did a show called Samurai Jack. And the two main characters were me as the samurai and Japanese actor Mako as the villainous demon wizard. And Mako had a very distinctive voice. He had, like, amazing texture, a heavy Japanese accent, and, you talk like this all the time. And one time they cast him as another character on the show other than Aku. And I was like, really? You guys have heard him talk, right? All right, well, if you need somebody to revoice that later, let me know. And I watched him from across the booth, and he didn't, like, try to change his voice. He didn't try to do some. He changed his voice a little bit, but more than anything, he just came at it from a different perspective. He acted that character so much differently than he acted Aku that when you watch it, that episode now, he's like, I can't tell that's him. How can I not tell that's Mako? I mean, he was doing, you know, it was still his voice, there was still the texture, but it was a very different character. And I'm like, oh, this is about acting.
Right.
Got it. 6 years into my career. Thank you
yeah.
for that masterclass. Yeah. You know.
So, do you ever teach?
I don't.
What are you doing predominantly now? Are you just mostly voice?
Yeah, doing the voiceover stuff, doing stuff for Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Oh, that's true, of course.
A couple of web series things. I wrote and produced a web series called Inside the Legend, which was fun because it was character stuff.
And you're writing it as well, huh?
Yeah.
Where can people find that?
That's insidethelegend.com. The episodes are up on my damn channel on YouTube. That's the name of the channel.
DAMN channel?
Yes, my damn channel.
Is that your channel?
No, that's a company that they have a bunch of great shows on there, and they've just picked up Inside the Legend as part of their channel, so we're really happy.
So when I talked about young people coming up to us with their funny voices, but when young people do come up to you, after these many experiences, I mean a fabulous education at Yale, into being in... The inception almost of improv, certainly in LA,
right.
as coming from Chicago, as you played a major part of that, going into television as an actor, as a voiceover talent of incredible experience. What do you tell the hopeful kid? that comes up to you? Who has that energy
right.
from the people's gaze?
It's funny. These days, the one thing I tell them is, go to D. Bradley Baker's website, iwanttobeavoiceactor.com. Because, I don't know if you've...
I've never seen it.
You should
I mean,
look
I know
at
D.
it. D has distilled all of the stuff that you would try to remember to tell somebody mm-hmm. when they come up to you and ask that question.
That's a great idea.
And it's fantastic. It's like, it's not only answers to all those questions, it's the questions you should ask yourself if you're serious about this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, plus some links to, you know, like Uri Lowenthal and Tara Platt's book, you know, voice acting, voice actor, and a bunch of other resources. And it's an amazing first step. And it also takes the pressure off me trying to explain.
You can send them to a website.
Exactly. Go to this. I want to be, not want to be, want to be a voice actor.com. And it's a fantastic resource. Because the thing is, it's so hard to tell, unless you've watched someone perform, whether they have that thing. And even then, you can't tell whether they have the temperament and the burning desire, you know, to make it through. And no one can really can tell that except them. And my path into voiceover, especially, is so random that there's really no lesson in it for anybody else. Like, well, the main thing you need to do is get on a sketch comedy show, then make sure they do some animation on them, and then
exactly.
get an agent who comes and wants to represent you, and then, you know, it's like right, the old joke. Right. It's like, first, step one, get $1 million.
Yep.
Step two.
Then invest it in Steve Martin's.
Right.
How to make $1 million in real estate. Okay, first, get $1 million.
Right.
Then, you know,
invest
you make
it in real estate.
In real estate. I'll let you go. Thanks so much. But let me, an English Lit major
yeah.
from Yale University, what are a couple of your favorite novels?
You know what's funny? The books that I carry with me, wherever I go.
Always.
Always. Alice in Wonderland and The Phantom Tollbooth.
Really? Still The Phantom Tollbooth?
Still The Phantom Tollbooth. It is such an amazing exploration of English language, you know? And also, it tells you, it's like, if you're bored in this world, it's probably because you're being boring. Which I think is, it's something I say to my kids and they hate me for it. It's like, I'm bored. It's like, well, you should do something exciting then. But that's what that book is about. It's like, there's so much in this world that's worth looking at and exploring. And you're probably looking right past it.
Phil is a great guy. Can I do one commercial? Hey, May 2nd at 10:30 p.m. on MTV is a show Zach Stone is going to be famous. It's on MTV, May 2nd at 10:30 p.m. I'm in the show and I really think it's good. So I would love for you to watch and tell me what you think. Phil Lamar, it's rare that you actually call a person a gentleman and a scholar, and you're absolutely correct, but he certainly is a gentleman and a scholar, and it's wonderful spending time with him. He's a great guy. Thanks to Phil. Thanks to Emily Wilson for producing. Thanks to Chris, Katie, everybody at Nerdist Industries. Thanks to McPherson Guitars for helping me out on a live show. Come out to see a live show. I'm all over. Please watch Zach Stone on May 2nd at 10:30. But thanks so much, and we'll talk to you next time. Bye.
Now leaving Nerdist.com.